Welcome to the A-Team Group podcast on the future of fighting financial crime, recorded at the RegTech Summit for Capital Markets held on October the 4th, 2018 in the City of London. In this keynote address, Che Sidanius, the Global Head of Financial Regulatory and Industry Affairs at Thomson Reuters, now known as Refinitiv, outlines the true cost of financial crime, discusses how government, society and business can help drive change, analyzes best practices for public and private information sharing to fight financial crime, and explores how to manage complex and sometimes conflicting regulatory regimes.
Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Just take a real quick show of hands. Who here is either in compliance or involved in anti-money laundering rules? If you could raise your hand really quickly, just so I get a sense. Okay, good. So you may think, well, what does AML KYC have to do with kind of this afternoon? It is very much the heart and the intersection of a number of topics that we've covered this morning and that we'll cover later on today, which is to do about regulatory compliance, the use of data, technology, and how you stay ahead of that, and obviously looking at how you make that process more efficient, reduce costs, increase effectiveness. So what I'll be talking today is really how we as an organization are dealing with many of these challenges. And it gets to a little bit about my role in the organization. So I joined about a year ago as a function of the fact that our management wanted to have a much more strategic outlook in terms of who we are, how do we service our clients, how do we have an outlook much broader than just the tactical everyday of servicing our clients, but ensuring that we could adapt quickly and then effectively working throughout our organization in terms of achieving a sort of a strategic outlook in terms of, you know, where we placed our capital and a timeline. So I'm a bit of like the connecting tissue. So I'm not in compliance. I sit within the business. And I'm sort of, as I said, the connecting tissue through our business, legal, operations, throughout organizations sort of have a plan in terms of ensuring that we all have a clear idea in terms of what our strategy is. And as a function of that, similarly working with not only our clients, but the whole anti-money laundering ecosystem, both public and private sector, and how we can engage more broadly. So the comments I have this morning is a reflection of where we are, as far as my perspective is, and where do we go from here. So hopefully that will be of interest to you. So I'll briefly talk about where we are today in the anti-money laundering regime, where we are today in fighting financial crime. In Europe, we've been at this for over 30 years. There's a fifth anti-money laundering directive. There'll probably be a sixth and probably be a seventh. And that's the same throughout each jurisdiction. And then we'll also talk about the future in terms of not just within the private sector, but some of the initiatives that we are involved with and how we see this whole topic evolve over the next few years. Right, so let's start with where we are today. While many of the regulatory changes as a function of the financial crisis are either behind us or right in front of us, and it was referred to this morning that we have a clear idea that the dust has settled a bit, in the space of financial crime and anti-money laundering, that's only going to increase. The impacts to banks and the general awareness of financial crime activity, whether it's corruption or sanctions regime, political exposed persons, is actually cutting to the hearts of what many banks are dealing with at the moment. Politically, it's at the highest level of both governments and regulators. You've probably seen almost every single day there's some news event about a bank being caught doing something that they shouldn't. The amount of penalties that are being issued are unprecedented and actually cuts to the heart not only the survivability of a particular bank, and I can mention a number of them, but actually the awareness that anti-money laundering and financial crime can actually impact the stability of a banking system. And I point to Latvia, I point to Denmark, and a number of other jurisdictions. So the whole topic of money laundering is really shifting away from this KYC, AML thinking, compliance thinking, into much more strategic in terms of how firms manage this more broadly. And I will admit that I used to be a regulator. I used to work at the New York Fed during the financial crisis. And many of the things that I saw, or the lessons learned from that crisis in terms of understanding the systemic impact of risks, such as counterparty credit risk, I see very much in the AML space. If you're deemed to be a money launderer, and we'll talk about some examples of this, some banks potentially have their banking license at risk, they have their access to the dollar funding market at risk, if FinCEN deems them to be a money launderer, and that will lead to an immediate run on the bank, and that's it. So these are just some examples of some of the recent events. Also as a function in terms of where we are today is really around where are we? So this is kind of my sense of the current state. Money laundering is becoming more global. Criminals are becoming more sophisticated. And in fact, proceeds from in some regions appears to be increasing exponentially. So the graph on the top is from our World Check data. So we're clearly a data provider in terms of screening. And so the data that we see is that the global nature of money laundering is really increasing. And then the graph on the bottom is from a UN report that looks at illicit funds in the U.S. alone. And clearly you see that's going nowhere but up. We can all agree that the entire regime, anti-money laundering regime, is built on technical compliance rather than actually is it effective or not effective. And this is not a controversial statement, by the way. The regulators know this, the law enforcement know this, and certainly banks know this, who are spending unprecedented amounts on complying. And it's really about the box-ticking exercise, right? Do you have policy and procedures? Do you have an anti-money laundering officer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But is it actually working? And most of us would agree that it's not. I mean, the latest UN report, which is well cited, is that less than 1% of illicit funds get caught or seized in the banking system. Regulatory change and some competing or conflicting regulatory changes has become very difficult to manage. And data protection rules is an example of that. Where both for us and for the banks and for any organization, how do you manage to comply with data protection rules which restricts how you use data and AML rules that tries to enhance the using of processing data? And the two regimes don't there's no coherence between them. So that's another thing that we're doing in terms of ensuring that both sides of that regime, that there's a bit of coherence. So these are very, you know, global and complex things to manage. So in effect, you have 4% of your annual turnover at risk with GDPR. And on the other hand, you have your banking license and access to a funding market at risk if you're deemed to be going too far with data protection. And then there is also well recognized that as a function of a number of trends following the financial crisis, that banks are de-risking. So they're withdrawing from many of the regions that they've served before, which is leading for regional banks to lose access to the financial system, which obviously has an impact on economic development and economic growth. Money laundering is inherently difficult to quantify, of course. So we issued a report that we have outside. We're more than willing to get a copy of it if you want. We have our stand outside there with James, Paul, and Alex, where we surveyed 2,300 companies in 19 jurisdictions, all C-suite global firms, and trying to estimate the amount that they lose because of corruption, the amount that they spend and the figures are just astronomical. So what we found is 1.5 trillion is lost in the turnover, and 1.3 trillion is being spent. So when you combine what you lose and what you spend, it equates to around 6.6% of firms' annual turnover, which is an astronomical figure. Imagine if you would shave a few points of that and what that would do to your return on equity and the rest. Almost half of firms were victims of financial crime. And working with a number of NGOs to look at particular topics that we're quite keen on tackling, and one of them is modern slavery. It's estimated that 40 million people are victims of modern slavery, which is the third largest revenue generator, and that figure, the 40 million, is higher than when slavery was legal. And that's just not good enough. And then I mentioned the UN report that they estimate 5% of global GDP comes from illicit funds, and that's just from organized crime, doesn't include other criminal activity. And the banking system, from our partners at Europol, that the banking system is still the preferred vehicle of choice. So there's more for us to do. And just to put things in perspective, right? So the 1.5 trillion that's lost in corporate turnover equates to more than any country's single GDP, with the exception of the 10 largest. Modern slavery, right? It's more than, if you looked at the largest city in the world, two of them, Shanghai and Beijing, it's twice that of the population of Shanghai. You're in Shanghai, you look to your left, you look to your right, and they're all being sold and used for slavery, which is five times the population of London. And then you're all aware of this. I'm not going to spend too much time on this piece, but you know, let's again put things where we are. There's substantial compliance costs. It's leading to financial exclusion. We're all dealing with a rapidly evolving technology era, and it's really about how you deploy that capital in a way that reduces costs and increases efficiency, including ourselves. We're a technology company at the heart of what we do. And then, of course, we have an incredibly complex regulatory environment. And we can't forget that many of you, I'm sure, operate globally, and there's a number of regulatory regimes, GDPR, data privacy excluded, that's becoming much more complex in terms of not just understanding what they are, interpreting what they are, but then devising a strategy for how to deal with it and then being coherent without the organization in terms of ensuring that everyone's aware of what are we doing, why are we doing it, and understanding the implications to your business. Right. Not very uplifting, but where do we go from here? And one of the things that we're quite involved with, so we're a global company, so we've been quite active more broadly. And I would say that from our perspective, the outlook is quite encouraging in terms of a broader recognition that the current regime that we live in, we need to do better. So the first one is that there's absolutely a recognition that criminal activity like terrorism, money laundering, is really global, and the response needs to be global. The use of technology and information sharing is absolutely vital in order not just to look at individual transactions, but actually to map the network, which I'll show you an example in a bit. And then we talked about conflicting regulatory requirements. So we're engaged both with the G7 at the moment to put this issue, some of these issues at the next meeting next year. We're also involved with World Economic Forum. In addition, of course, to being quite active meeting with regulators to ensure that there's awareness of these inconsistencies in terms of the private sector being caught between conflicting regulatory regimes. Right, the network. For us, it's all about the network. And the example here is the Paris and Brussels attacks. And the whole point of this slide, and it's not a very good, you can't really see it clearly, But to put a fine point to it, right, the attackers in Paris and the attackers in Brussels were all connected. They were connected to the accomplices to help them, the organizers, and those who funded them. And that's the way we have to sort of move beyond our individual silos and really looking at the criminal network and how they operate. And this gets to the global nature. The Paris and Brussels attacks are connected to ISIS, are connected to Sharia Belgium network, are connected to al-Zarqawi. And the point that we're making here is that if we truly want to make a difference, then both the public and the private sector need to work together. And it's all about the information sharing and understanding where the risks lie in order to make the system or the anti-money laundering system more effective. Here's another example of how we use data. In terms of looking at, this is human trafficking, again, that the slides aren't, it's not very easy to see here, but what you see in the middle is a global picture of human trafficking in terms of where they go and where the destination and where the origin. And then you'll see, and I assume that you'll get copies of these, and then we do it by region in terms of which countries are actually affected and what the network looked like. And this is something that we're working with Ronnie Hong, who is an incredible woman. I started an organization called Ronnie's Voice. She used to be trafficked as a child. And has started an organization to raise awareness of the human trafficking issue in terms of actually using data to make the points in terms of where it happens, what's the topology. And so we're working with her to actually look at these questions. For the banks in this room, you have a particular problem when it comes to conflicting use of regulatory regimes. And I just thought it would be worth highlighting it to you. And again, I'm really referring to data privacy again. At the moment, it's going to affect you in three different ways. The first is SARS. At the moment, you don't, from a data privacy perspective, you don't really have a legal justification for issuing a SAR on an EU national. On top of which, you over-report anyway, which we all know, in which you will conflict with data privacy's proportionality principle. And it's not really clear on how that's going to be resolved. The second is the sanctions regime that, of course, globally don't really align. Different countries have different sanctions regimes. And it's not really clear on what legal justification you have from an EU perspective to report on an EU national who happens to be a Cuban national at the same time, because it's a requirement by US law to report on Cuban nationals. And the third is data retention. GDPR restricts how you hold data retention, or how long you hold data. AML, of course, enhances it. So God forbid if you delete data on an individual who then happens to be an organizer of a terrorist attack, and the US regulators come, knocks on your door, says, you know, give me your data on this individual, says, well, I had to delete it because I had to meet data privacy rules. Right, last few minutes, and then I'll open up for questions if you have any. So as a sign of our commitment, we formed a public and private sector coalition on the back of Davos last year with the World Economic Forum, Europol, a number of other organizations. The one on the right there is Ronnie's Voice, and more have been added actually since we did this. It really, with a few objectives. One is to raise awareness of some of the points that I made in terms of the current regime is just not good enough. We need to do better. We need to work more collaboratively, both public and private sector. And there's a number of initiatives that we're involved with. We're there, hoping to take that to Davos again next year as an event. And then something else I mentioned earlier on, making the point that anti-money laundering rules, it's not just about compliance. It really gets to the heart of the financial integrity, potentially, of a banking system. Because AML, again, this is my view, the AML regime has a fatal flaw. And I base this on my experience as a former regulator at the Bank of England and the New York Fed. All the banks in this room are based, you're judged on a number of criteria. And they're all the same globally. They have their different acronyms, but they're all the same. You know, what's the level of capital? What's the quality of your assets, quality of your management, volatility of earnings, liquidity position, sensitivity to market risk? And I'm most familiar with the New York Fed one, so CAMELS, for those who are involved in that. And so it's a 1 to 5 rating, 1 being the best, 5 being the worst. Point being, hey, you can be rated number 1 in all of these, but you still find yourself under liquidation within a week. Right? Because if you're deemed to be a money launderer and you lose access, as I said, to the funding market, US or Euro, or what have you, it'll be a run on the bank. And this happened before, right? It's not theoretical. ABLV, as many of you will know, one of the largest Latvian banks, deemed to be an institutional, quote unquote, institutional money launderer. And there's a report that the US Treasury issued, fascinating reading, actually, in February, and they died within days, right? Because it was found that they were beyond, you know, saving. You know, they had an enormous amount of shell companies, enormous amount of non-resident deposits of questionable nature. So the 12th of Feb, they lost access to the dollar funding. 600 million euros disappeared. ECB, a week after that, suspended all their payments, and that was it. They were done. So fine. But it doesn't end there. Because then you ask yourself, where does the money go? Right? And what we found was, and this is based on some investigative reporting, really, from really fantastic work, is a flight to quality. So where does the money go? Okay, some of it goes back to Russia, goes to Germany, goes to Switzerland. And then it goes to the UK, some to Cyprus, and some of the neighboring countries. So now low-risk jurisdictions have now become high-risk. And the point of this slide is just to show the systemic nature of how these illicit funds flow into our banking system. And you have to think of it. You have to think of it that way. I think I only have a few more minutes. So I'm not going to. This is more about the need for a single customer view. You know, a number of financial services organizations are very siloed. I mean, you know all this more than I, and it's for us, we're big proponents of having a much more holistic understanding of the customers and the third-party suppliers that you deal with. Financial crime is not going anywhere in terms of the regulations and the requirements. They're only going to come, you know, and they're becoming much more, as I said before, there's awareness at the highest political level now that something needs to be done. And I think that's all I have. So I'll happy to take any questions if you have any.
Hi, good morning. Okay. Inevitable question about cryptocurrencies. Rather than just jump on the immediate obvious implication of cryptocurrency, high risk and so on, I'm much more interested in longer term, as in for cryptocurrencies after 2 years from now, say. What do you think would be the impact of cryptocurrencies as they may be by then evolved, with perhaps some being run by sovereign countries or central banks and so on,
yep,
on financial crime?
Yep, great question. Very topical and very timely. So we're actually organizing, as Refinitiv, we're organizing a conference the 21st of May, November, on this very question in terms of how do you apply the 40 FATF standards in a way that makes sense in terms of how cryptocurrencies actually work. And when I say cryptocurrencies, there's a vast array of business models. And they tend to be, you know, lumped into a single unit, which they are not. And so we are organizing a conference with law enforcement. So Europol is going to be there, MoneyVal, supervisors, and GDF, which is a Cryptocurrency Association, to really talk about what is a prudent AML regime actually look like in the crypto space. And it's an example of the public-private partnership that we talked about. Because, and I used to be a regulator, you know, all the sympathy, right? But the risk is that a standard is applied in a way that doesn't actually reflect what the risks really are. Now, I have my own personal view in terms of some of the business models that are designed to be anonymous and are rife with fraud. And there's been examples of that all across the world. In Asia, there was a case where $660 million was defrauded. And there's been a number of those. So it's a very topical one. I don't have a view myself in terms of where we are 2 years from now, but it's very much the idea of working together to really build trust, build understanding for regulators, law enforcement, to kind of build the building blocks for that, which we're going to do globally, by the way. We're doing one in London. We're going to do one in Asia. We'll do probably one in Paris because the French government's very interested in the U.S., etc. So that's my answer to your question. Yes.
Gerald Spungen, HSBC. Fascinating talk. Thanks for that. Future does look bleak somewhat. So interesting positioning on some of the analytics, the data-driven insights. I was actually fascinated by the network analysis picture that you put in, the networks of all those criminal activities. So the question is, with network analysis as an example, so once you go many layers down, you know, person related to another person who's related to another person. Ultimately, everyone is related to everyone. So the question is, how do you manage both intended and unintended bias, especially in the context of how do you interpret the data?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I'll answer it in two ways. The first, where we are now, and then the real risk that we all have to be careful of is when we start using AI machine learning to ensure that there's not inherent bias in the code. So where we are now, so as a firm, so we collect data publicly sourced really from a number of parameters, right? One, if you've been convicted. Second, if your name is on a sanctions list, or if you've been charged with some activity, right? So it's, you know, pre-conviction, post-conviction kind of stuff. So we don't just suck up information on it. Absolutely not. We only take information. If you're on a sanctions list, you know, you've been charged with doing something nefarious, to ensure that, you know, banks and other organizations have a view, and it's their view, their risk view, in terms of who they do business with. So we don't make any of those decisions. We only standardize the data sets. So we're being outsourced in a way to do that. And the benefit of that is that you don't have different data methodologies, different data standardizations, which would be very difficult for law enforcement and others to actually make any sense of it. So we don't take a view of an individual, whether they're risky or not. We just, you know, collect information in terms of if Che has actually been charged with fraud in Tanzania or China, so that if I then come to you, knock on the door, I want to do business with you, they have an idea of who I actually am. But the point about a bias, because at the moment, for most organizations, it's very manual, which makes it very expensive, and there's a need to automate it, to make it more efficient, and the whole bias question absolutely is critical, not just in the money laundering space, but how we actually deploy technology. And the regulators will come and tell you, right? They will say, okay, that's fine that you use machine learning and AI, but you're going to have to explain to me how it works, the assumptions that are being made. And inherently, machine learning, right, it starts building on its own logic, and mapping that logic is going to be very complex.
Just picking up on that last point about using AI, it seems to me that you're suggesting that only a supervised machine learning approach would work as opposed to unsupervised AI, or do you think that unsupervised AI can still yield the kind of results that we need without too many false positives and too many biases that could contaminate it?
Okay, so I take supervised in terms of, I assume by supervised you mean that a regulator is going to look and ask, versus having a management system to actually ensure that the code is good and it's being used in the way it was intended. And I know we have regulators in here. They will do reviews on this kind of stuff, right? They will be required. They will require us to explain how our technology is being deployed when it comes to these topics. Now, it's a challenge for them because they may not be, you know, IT experts or coding experts, but the regulatory framework is there already to ensure that, and they'll do safety and soundness reviews as they do with other sort of risk factors. So you'll have to have a management sort of infrastructure to have a think about how you manage that.
Thank you for listening to the 18 Group podcast on the future of fighting financial crime, and we hope you found the content both valuable and informative. For more RegTech insights, our upcoming RegTech Summit New York will be held on the 15th of November in New York City. Financial institutions are invited to sign up for free at either datamanagementreview.com or intelligenttradingtechnology.com.